You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the American League West. I'm Richard Justice of MLB.com. We're joined today by our five correspondents talking about one of the most competitive divisions in all of baseball. I'm joined by my friend Alan Gonzalez of MLB.com. Alan, 2 weeks to go to spring training. When I look at the Angels, I see a team, not many holes, but, you know, question marks like C.J. Wilson, Josh Hamilton. Right now, what do you think is first on Jerry DePoto's mind? What way does he have a particular concern or one more thing he'd like to do, anything like that?
Hey, Richard, I don't know that he has anything else that he wants to do this offseason. It looks like they're pretty much set. Looks like they've been pretty much set on the major league side ever since they got Matt Joyce for Kevin Jepsen in the middle of December. But one thing that you got to keep in mind with the Angels, they're going to go into this season with a little bit of payroll flexibility. And although they like the makeup of the 25-man roster right now where it stands, and they like the layers of depth that they've added beyond that, they're fairly comfortable below the luxury tax threshold right now. And I think what that means is maybe for the first time, for the first time since this front office took over 3.5 years ago, they go into a season with the cushion, with the room to make some upgrades on the roster if they need to. Looking ahead here, I think July is going to be a very interesting month for them, because if they need that starting pitcher, they could go out and acquire it and take on the extra money because they have it. If they need a second baseman, they could go out on the market and they could acquire it. I think right now they're just going to go with what they have. And just looking ahead to spring training, you know, the big question is going to be at second base. They have four guys competing for that spot. Nobody's going to replicate Howie Kendrick's production there solely. They're going to have Josh Rutledge, Johnny Giovitella, Taylor Featherston, a Rule 5 pick, and Grant Green, an incumbent, coming in, competing for the starting second base job, competing for at-bats, the utility infielder. That's going to be the one competition to watch. And I think the second one is going to be how that rotation unfolds in the bottom. If Garrett Richards is healthy to open up the season, then it's going to be just one spot. You're looking at Andrew Heaney, you're looking at Hector Santiago, and you're looking at Nick Tropiano trying to win a job in spring training. I think those are the only two question marks that they really have going into the year, but I think they feel like they have the candidates to kind of step up and embrace that role.
I want to ask you about second base. Do you think there's a favorite there, or is this just a matter of four guys going to fight it out for, you know, they're going to give them all equal at bats and make a decision? Is there a defensive favorite, an offensive favorite? What do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what. The guy that they went out and got was Josh Rutledge. Right. He was a guy that they were already targeting even before they traded Howie Kendrick. And if you remember, on that last full day of the winter meetings, Howie Kendrick was traded, and then minutes later we find out that they just got Josh Rutledge from the Rockies. He was a guy that they wanted, even as their utility infielder, if they were going to hold on to Howie Kendrick. They like him. They like what he's shown in the little spurts where he's taken over for Troy Tulowitzki in Colorado. But I heard that one really good dark horse candidate in this is Johnny Giovitella, a guy that they simply got off waivers from the Royals, didn't really have any opportunities to play with Omar Infante there. And, you know, his numbers aren't outstanding, but what they really like about him is his plate discipline. He's a guy who works counts, takes walks. That's really big for the Angels, and he's also out of options. So if you keep Johnny Giovitella on your major league club, now you kind of you have more depth than if, say, you were going to go with Josh Rutledge and then you have to slip Giovitella through waivers. I heard he's a pretty good dark horse candidate, but Josh Rutledge has a very good shot to win this job. The Angels haven't had a Rule 5 draft pick stick on their roster since Derek Turnbow in 2000, but they really like Taylor Featherston because they feel like he's the ideal utility guy for a major league club. And Grant Green's been there. They've seen what he's done. They've never really been able to find a position for him since acquiring him from the A's for Alberto Callazo. But second base is easily the position that he's most comfortable at. So, I mean, I really do see four guys here that have a legit shot of winning playing time. And I think the other key, too, is none of these guys really play third base. The Angels got to find somebody who can play third base, who's comfortable there in case something happens to David Freese. They traded for Kyle Kubica, but they're not projecting him to be ready until next season. So they need one of these guys to also get some work at third base this spring because they need somewhat of a safety net for David Freese.
The other thing is, you know, the Angels farm system gets widely panned, and obviously Jerry DePoto is going to he's working to turn that around. But I see production from Cam Bedrosian, from that guy in center field, Trout, from Calhoun, from Crone, from Richards, from Shoemaker. It seems to me that maybe, I don't know what you look for in numbers, but in terms of guys stepping in and doing a good job last year, they got a huge lift from their farm system. I don't know that they lead the majors in victories without, and I'm sitting Trout aside, without the production they got, unexpected maybe in some cases, from their farm system. How would you look at their farm system?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Richard. And, you know, the reason why they're always ranked dead last, and I don't know what Baseball America is going to rank them this year. It's not going to be very high. I know Keith Law already had them 29th. And, you know, they're not going to be very high this year either, but they've been ranked dead last by Baseball America the previous 2 years. And the biggest reason for that is they look Baseball America relies really heavily on pre-draft rankings of players and how they had guys stacked up going into the draft. And the Angels were a team that were without a first-round pick for like 3 out of 4 years before this past June. And it's true, they don't really have a lot of high-end talent in their farm system because they've made trades with draft pick compensation. They've signed free agents with draft pick compensation, I mean, and they've traded a lot of their minor league guys to get guys like Zach Greinke and a bunch of these other players that they've acquired because they're making a run at the title. But I think the thing that the Angels have done a very good job of, and I think it does go a little bit overlooked, they've done a very good job on the development side. And the thing that they say is, if you're not getting the high draft picks, you better compensate for that with player development. And I think if you look at the contributions of a guy like Matt Shoemaker, who went undrafted out of Eastern Michigan in 2008, he almost won a Rookie of the Year this year. Efren Navarro, a 50th round pick out of Arizona, made some really good contributions last year and even made their playoff roster. And you can go all through the roster and find these guys. Mike Morin, who stepped in and is going to be the seventh inning reliever this coming season, had a great year. Garrett Richards emerged as a Cy Young candidate, another guy from their farm system. Cole Calhoun, a guy that they drafted in 2011 simply because they needed prospects in the upper levels of their system who could rise quickly. Cole Calhoun was a guy with a high floor. Not a high ceiling, but a high floor, and they thought that, you know, he could be ready pretty soon. Cole Calhoun established himself as one of the best leadoff hitters in baseball last year. So I think even though they haven't had the draft picks, even though they've traded away some prospects and win-now deals, I think they've done a really good job in the development side. And now the key is bringing in the players that are more high-end, bringing in, you know, being able to draft someone like Sean Newcomb, bringing in Nick Tropiano and Andrew Heaney, or committing $15 million to Roberto Valdequin. I think that was the next step for them. And I think they're really making some strides. Again, I don't think they have much high-end talent yet. I mean, they only had two players in the top 100 of MLB.com's list, and that was Heaney and Newcomb. But I think they're doing a pretty good job of supplementing at different positions right now.
What do you think, after a season, after you win 98 games, what do you think that does psychologically for the clubhouse? Because you had guys from other organizations, Josh and Albert, and, you know, Trout was a young guy. So now, as a group, they've done it. What do you think that does for them, the confidence-wise it does, as they step onto the field in spring training and get ready?
Yeah, I think it's pretty big just because they finally found their blueprint as a team. And this is a club that ever since Jerry DePoto came in November, and I know a lot of some of these signings weren't his doing, but, you know, you come in November 2011, you bring in an Albert Pujols, you bring in a C.J. Wilson, you bring in Zach Greinke midseason. The following season, you blow that up, you bring in Josh Hamilton. And I think those first 2-3 years, a lot of guys were just trying to find their role, trying to figure out how they can contribute to a winning team. And I think last offseason, when they didn't make any big splashes and they just made the subtle moves like bringing Joe Smith as an eighth inning guy, trading for Houston Street midseason, using Mark Trumbo to get a couple of young starting pitchers. No splashy deals, no big clubhouse personalities. I think that was big in terms of just maybe a little bit of consistency in the clubhouse and players just trying to figure out how they fit in, how they can fit into a winning team. And, you know, they have a really star-studded roster, and I know a lot of people always project them to win the AL West, but, you know, they overcame a lot last year with, you know, significant injuries to David Freese and Cole Calhoun. They lost two starting pitchers in August, and this is from a team that didn't really have any organizational starting pitching depth. They didn't get much out of Josh Hamilton, and to still win 98 games, still have the best record in baseball. I know it ended way too quickly for them. That sometimes is just a randomness of a postseason series. But I think they kind of found their way in terms of, you know, how to win with this group. And I think the front office's goal this offseason was to kind of shed that label of that this is a team that has to win now, and if they don't win now, they're going to hit that wall like the Phillies are doing right now, where they have a lot of bloated contracts and they have to be uncompetitive for many years to come. That's why they're trying to supplement with those young players coming up, so that their goal is to crank out as many of these 90-win seasons as possible. And they feel like if you could win 90 games, you're going to give yourself a good shot to win a World Series every year.
Yeah, and you know, you can see the idea of replenishing from below with the trade for the third baseman, Haney, Tropiano. So the Angels have it going right now. And great stuff as always, Alan, and we'll see you soon.
All right, Richard, thanks.
Joined by Jane Lee of MLB.com. Jane, I just want to say, first of all, before we get to the nitty-gritty, you wrote a fantastic story this week on, or maybe it was last week, on Sam Full, who is a big league baseball player. I joke with him in the past that he's at the front of every line. He's a better writer than a lot of us are. He's a great athlete, and he's a guy who's made it to this far in the big leagues with type 1 diabetes. And for people who haven't read it, he's from Stanford University. People who haven't read it, you got to go to athletics.com or MLB.com and get this story on Sam Full. It's just fantastic. But what did you take away? Can you just tell people briefly his story and how inspiring it is?
Yeah, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 10. And, you know, he was explaining to me, you know, he was already kind of a go-getter as a kid, an inspired kid, and, you know, with a lot of goals and dreams, just like any other kid, always liked sports. And even when he was diagnosed, he didn't think much of it, but then it was a couple years later when he came in contact with, you know, a few professional athletes with type 1 diabetes, and they were explaining to him, you know, this is a challenge. You know, you do have a challenge ahead of you. And he kind of just embraced that. You know, he didn't realize how much of a challenge it would be, but he almost liked it that way because he liked, you know, having that challenge. And that's kind of what he tells kids these days is, you know, look, this isn't easy. You know, you're going to be in, you know, like him, like what he does, he has to, you know, inject himself with insulin every single day in the clubhouse, in the dugout. I mean, you see it. And he has to be very careful with it. And this is what, you know, a ton of kids are trying to do, and maybe they feel inhibited by it. But, you know, he really wants to put it out there and let them know, like, this doesn't have to prevent you from doing anything, whether it's, you know, athletically, academically, you know, socially, any department of your life, like this doesn't have to inhibit you. And so a few years ago, he got to thinking and, you know, he thought there's a ton of sports camps out there. There's a ton of diabetes camps out there, but there's not a sports camp for people with diabetes. And so that's how this diabetes camp kind of came to fruition. And he's been doing it every year. And it was great listening to him because you can really tell just how much joy it brings him. He says it's not an easy camp to put together, and you can imagine, you know, how much goes into it because it really isn't just any other sports camp. I mean, there's a ton of medical staff, just a lot that goes into it. And he said it's probably the most stressful weeks leading up to it, and even the weekend itself is stressful. But at the end of it, you know, when he's talking to the parents, he's talking to the kids, and they, you know, he can see the relief just in their eyes, listening, like, hey, we can do this. He says that's just, you know, the greatest feeling ever. He always takes, like, an hour after the camp ends and the tenor reflects and is amazed at, you know, what they've been able to do. So it's pretty great.
Yeah, you know, Sam Fuld's one of those guys, probably be a success in anything he attempted and whatever he attempts after baseball. And for you and I, people like you and I, it's like he's one of the guys that makes it, like when you write a story like that, and you get to tell his story, it makes you feel good, you know, all over because his story's so great and the guy is so good. But anyway, back on the field, the A's had some news, not good news. Sean Doolittle is got a rotator cuff tear, the closer, and is going to try to avoid surgery, but doubtful for opening day. I'm going to ask you first, any idea when Sean can be back first? And second, how does Bob Melvin line up his bullpen now without Sean Doolittle?
Yeah, they're really kind of taking it day by day. I know a lot of fans are eager to know, well, you know, okay, well, if not opening day, then when? But they don't even have a timetable for, you know, him to start throwing again. He just received a PRP injection, it's a plasma injection, and he can't do anything for the next 3 weeks or so. You know, it's not until those 3-4 weeks are over can they evaluate him again. And even then, you know, they hope that this injection kind of calms things down in his shoulder, helps with the inflammation and the irritation. But if it doesn't, or it doesn't as much as they want it to, you know, then maybe they have him rest even more, or they look at other options. So they're not about to, you know, get in front of this and say, well, you know, hopefully we'll have him back at the end of April or sometime in May. They just don't know because they don't know how his shoulder is going to react to the treatment. Now, the doctors right now are really encouraged, you know, that they believe he will not need surgery, which is good news. They believe it's just a slight tear. Because when you hear about, you know, those shoulder tears, well, you're thinking, well, those can sometimes be career-threatening, but this is just the slightest of tears. And, you know, right now they're just more so worried about the inflammation and the irritation in it. And they actually believe he was pitching with it a lot of last season. So they're hopeful that if, you know, they can get it down a little bit, he'll be able to pitch, you know, with it and without pain. But until that time, knowing they'll be without him come opening day, you know, they still do have several options in their bullpen to close. They have Tyler Clippard. They have Eric O'Flaherty. They have Ryan Cook. And all three of those guys, you know, have closer material. Tyler Clippard, of course, has even done it with the Nationals. Ryan Cook's done it for a little bit. And Eric O'Flaherty, you know, he's kind of always been seen as that's kind of been the next step for him. You know, he's a tremendous setup guy. But, you know, I know the organization's always looked at him as a potential closer, too. So I don't think they're lacking in arms to replace Doolittle at closer. And certainly they have the bullpen depth to kind of withstand this. It's still a tremendous loss. You know, you look at what he did last year, making the All-Star team for the first time. You know, his strikeout ratio is just insane, and just how dominant he was for them at times. But, you know, they're just encouraged that it's nothing more serious, at least not at the moment.
And Jane, let me ask you, I guess in the bigger picture of first base, second base, left field, catcher, is Ben Zobrist going to play a lot of different positions? I guess what I'm asking, who's going to play second and who's going to play left? How do you think those at-bats will break down?
As it looks right now, you kind of see Zobrist as the everyday guy at second. And I think
does that mean Sogard will be a guy off the bench?
Yes, which is, you know, it's going to be different for him. I mean, he kind of got used to playing every day, but this was the role that I think they envisioned for Sogard. You know, when he first came up and, you know, as it happened, he kind of ended up playing every day. And he's terrific defensively, and that's why he is a great option off the bench. But when you get a Ben Zobrist, who gives you a little bit more on offense, you know, you're going to put him in there every day. And when you already have Craig Gentry and Sam Fuld to kind of share time in left field, you know, you want to keep Zobrist at second. No, he is a guy that can play left, and, you know, the offseason's not over. The A's could go out and get themselves another second baseman. They've been linked to a few of the Cuban guys that they could end up getting. And if that does happen, then, yeah, Zobrist would play in left field more. But as the roster stands right now, I think they do see him as their everyday second baseman with Sogard on the bench. Or, you know, he does have an option left, and he is the type of guy where he needs his at-bats. He needs his consistent at-bats to stay fresh. And it wouldn't surprise me if they maybe started him at AAA at the start of the season. And they have other options. They have Andy Perino. They have Tyler Ladendorf, who could maybe fill that backup role. Now, granted, you know, you might want to stick with Sogard, considering what he's, you know, done for you over the past few years. But there is something to stay in, you know, fresh and up to date with at bats, and so that is something that wouldn't surprise me if that did happen.
At the end of the day, after all the moves that Billy Beane made, do you think he's pretty pleased, and do you think he thinks the A's are capable of contending in 2015?
Oh yeah, this is a GM that goes into every season believing that his team will contend. You know, he doesn't just rebuild with the thinking of, okay, well, we're going to be good in 2 or 3 years. He doesn't see the point of that. You know, why are you playing if you're not competing every single year? And that's why he's kind of been doing this rebuild on the fly. You know, he's at first, I think everyone was wondering, well, what the heck is he doing? And now that you see everything he's done, I think it's 9 trades total, involving something like 27 players. You know, you put the pieces back together and you look at this club and you're like, wow, you know what? They've always had the rotation to contend. Their lineup's lengthened out, and you look at the roster and you think, you know, why not? You know, why can't they contend? And I think he feels the same way.
That's great. Okay, I appreciate it, Jane, and we'll talk to you in a week or two.
All right, sounds good.
Joined by Greg Johns of MLB.com, who covers the Mariners. Greg, as we're 2 weeks to go until spring training, it's been a very productive offseason for Jack Cerencik and the Mariners. Is there any last thing you think that's on Jack's list or his to-do list, his worry list, as we close in here on going to Arizona?
You know, I think Jack's done about exactly what he wanted on his to-do list, but as he would be the first to tell you, that a GM's job is never done, and they're always looking to upgrade where they can. And if there's a chance to do something, I'm sure they will. Last year, it was about this time or later that they got in with Fernando Rodney and brought him in, and obviously that was huge last year, an all-star closer. But I don't see a big move left. I think what's probably left is some minor moves if they can get a left-handed reliever on a minor league deal, or maybe even a starter if they get somebody to come in willing to take a minor league deal just to get some depth there. I think they're pretty close. They're where they want to be. It's an interesting team. They're pretty solid across the board this year, and that's something they haven't been able to say for a long, long time. You know, they just don't have a lot of glaring questions going in. And you know, it's not to say things won't come up. So if things do happen, you know, last year they signed Chris Young right before the start of the season, he turned out to be huge for him. So you never know where things are going to go once you get out there and guys, get dinged up or whatever. But I think as we sit right now, heading toward camp, they're in pretty good shape.
Greg, is there a player or players you're most interested in seeing in Arizona? It could be a prospect or, you know, a guy like Taijuan Walker who's trying to take the next step. What are you looking for when you get to Arizona?
Yeah, for me, you know, I always enjoy seeing the young guys that I just haven't seen a lot of them. Certainly, Taijuan is a big story, and Danny Hulson is another one I think that everybody's going to want to see how he's doing. He's not going to be a guy that impacts him right away, but he's spent all last year rehabbing from shoulder surgery, and there's a guy who's number 2 pick in the draft a few years ago that could be a big part of the future if he can get back and healthy. So he'll be one to watch. You know, for me, you know, I love the young stories, the guys that we haven't seen a whole lot of, and those are going to be guys like DJ Peterson and Patrick Kivlahan and Jordy Lara, some of these young hitters that have been showing so much promise down below, and guys are waiting on. They're waiting to see that impact. And, you know, there may not be a spot for him. There probably isn't a spot for him coming out of camp. But those are guys that, you know, be interesting to see, because depth of any organization is key, and something happens. And, you know, a good example is D.J. Peterson. People say, why do they keep playing him at third? Why was he in the Arizona Fall League playing third base? You got Kyle Seager at third base. And it's an interesting question. You know, and I asked Chris Gwynn, their minor league coordinator, and he's made a lot of sense. You know, he said, hey, D.J. Peterson, he can play first base. We can move him over there if we need him. He's played some there in college. He's played some in the minors. But why move a guy off third base when you don't know yet what might happen down the road? You know, Kyle Seager gets hurt. You want to have a top prospect ready. You don't want to move a guy off too soon. If you can keep him, at a position of need, in a tougher position than first base. You know, they want to keep Peterson at third as long as it's necessary. And if a spot comes open and they need a first baseman, boom. You know, I think they can move him over there, and he'll get some time there this spring. But, you know, those are the things I want to watch. The other guys, shoot, it'll be fun. It's going to be a fun camp. You know, the battle at shortstop is going to be interesting. A lot of guys coming back. You know, everybody wants to see Nelson Cruz. You know, there's a lot of stories. It's going to be a good fun camp. But I do like watching the young guys myself.
Greg, speaking of the competition at shortstop, does Miller make the team regardless, because he can play all over the place, or is that going to be one guy, Taylor or Miller, and the other guy goes to AAA to be ready?
Well, I think there's one big key on that, and that's Willie Bloomquist. If Bloomquist is healthy, and he's coming off a microfracture knee surgery, so there's no guarantee that he's going to be ready for the start of the season. If Willie's ready and full go, as they hope, and he hopes, then Miller or Taylor, whoever doesn't win that job, probably goes to Tacoma. They both got options. They're both young, and there's certainly no shame in being in Tacoma, a step away, a phone call away from coming in, being that guy again. So that's probably what happens if Willie is healthy. If Willie's not, yeah, the guy who's not starting shortstop is probably your utility guy, and Miller in particular, not to cast him out of the starting shortstop job, but he's a guy they talked about, you know, able to even play some outfield if necessary, and certainly has had some experience at third and second. So he last year, when Taylor was playing so well, they kind of worked Miller into that utility role some after Willie got hurt. So he's got some experience there, and that's not to say he's not dead even with Taylor going in for that starting shortstop job. That's the one position that's really up for grabs right now, and that will be one to watch from day one of camp.
Yeah, and the guy that doesn't win it, Lloyd McClendon, can look him in the eye and say, be ready down there. We learned that lesson last year.
Regarding
the rotation, where is the competition? Okay, there's Felix, there's Iwakuma. Does Paxton have that third spot locked up, or is it just five guys for three spots there at the end? How do you see that shaking out?
It's hard for me to imagine Paxton isn't one of the four anyway. J.A. Happ's the other guy.
Right.
You know, those four, Hernandez, Iwakuma, Happ, are definites, and Paxton, it would be hard-pressed not to make it. So really, the competition, is Reynis Elias, Taijuan Walker, and Erasmo Ramirez kind of on the outside there for that last spot. And that's, again, assuming all stays healthy, which is a tough thing to get, you know, even through a camp, let alone a full season with guys staying healthy. So at this point, that's going to be a heck of a battle there for that last spot, and we'll see what happens, once they break. You know, last year, shoot, everything was looking kind of crowded like this, and then Iwakuma, strained his ligament, his finger about this time when he's working out in California, caught it on a net, and yeah, he didn't see him for the next 2 months. You know, Walker came into camp and sore shoulder, and he didn't pitch much. So, you know, things happen. Everything changes when you get down there throwing. But, hey, right now they certainly have some good depth there and a heck of a battle for that last spot.
I would think the Mariners probably will be the favorite in the AL West. Certainly the Mariners or the Angels. How do you think the club, and I'm asked this, and I preface by saying the Nationals 2 years ago didn't handle expectations too well. Do you think expectations will have any impact on the manager, on Cano? Do the expectations creep into the clubhouse in any way, do you think, knowing this group as you do?
Well, they certainly can. you know, that's always a factor. I think it's really easy to be the under the radar team, or not. You know, it's easier, I should say. It's you know, you kind of go under the flow. Nobody's talking about you, and you come out and surprise people. That's a good way to go. But there's also that, hey, we want to be favorites. We want to be the team people are talking about. I don't think they view themselves as the favorites. I think they view themselves as a strong contender, and they want to go, you know, make that next step. I think they're burning from finishing a game out last year, and there's a lot of motivation to get in there. I think Cano is a huge factor in that clubhouse and dealing with exactly what you're talking about, because he's a guy, obviously, who's been in that exact situation, and carries a lot of influence, and certainly has that kind of fun attitude, you know, keeping things loose, but then knowing how to work and really setting an example of what it takes when it's time to get down to business. So he's a pretty good factor. I think McLennan has been with you know, obviously the Tigers through some pretty good seasons, certainly knows and has a good handle on and saying all the right things about how to deal with expectations. And his basic message, and they're going to hear it over and over, is, hey, we don't care about expectations. We care about preparation. You know, we don't care what anybody else is saying. We got to get ready. We got to get ready for the long haul, and that's going to be their focus from the start of camp.
You know, I was just noticing the Zips projections on Fangraphs has the Mariners with the best record in the American League. And again, it means nothing, but it tells you, like, Jack Cerenjic had a pretty nice two off seasons to have elevated this franchise in the eyes of fans, in the eyes of people like you and me. And actually, they did it on the field last year, too. So, fun time to be a Mariners fan. Greg, I appreciate you joining us, and we'll talk to you next week. See you soon.
You got it, Richard. Always good talking with you.
I'm joined by Brian McTaggart, who covers the Astros for MLB.com. Brian, you had I guess you would call it an honor. I certainly would, to accompany Craig Biggio to Cooperstown. As you watched him walk through the Hall of Fame, what were his emotions?
Well, let me first say it was an honor. I mean, Craig had asked me to go down there with him and, you know, to have a chance to be there with him for the first time in his adult and get to experience that with him was truly an honor. And, you know, hopefully the pictures and videos and stories, you know, we got to share that with the readers some. But, you know, watching Craig walk around there, and he said it himself, he truly was like a kid in a candy store. I mean, he was really blown away by a lot of the things that he saw, the history of the game, from, you know, the Hank Aaron things dedicated to Hank Aaron, which he really spent a lot of time with, to when we went down in the collections area with the stuff that's not on display, saw things like Babe Ruth's bat. You know, you could tell he was emotional a couple of times. The Hall of Fame has a cap of his that he wore in the World Series, and under the bill of that cap was a smiley face that a friend of his daughter, I believe, was ailing or had died, and her name was Smiley. He wrote that smiley face on her cap, and I could tell he was really happy that cap was going to be remembered forever in the Hall of Fame. So I know his wife, Patty, called it an amazing, emotional day, and I'm sure deep down for Craig it was too, but I think he was more excited than anything, and, you know, he really just ate the whole day up, and, you know, I've never seen him like he's been the last month since he's been elected. He's really become a lot more candid and out of his shell a little bit, and he's really enjoying every moment of it.
Do you think he's starting to grasp the membership in the club that he's about to join with Hank Aaron and Frank Robinson and Sandy Koufax and the best of the best of the best? How is he dealing with getting his mind around something like this?
Yeah, I think he still is. I think last week went a long way towards that. But when we went into the gallery that has all the plaques, I'm sure you've been there, Richard, a few times, That was really that's really an area where it hits you, because there's all the names and the faces and the accomplishments of the 212 players that are in the Hall of Fame, and some of them are guys that he knows, like Yogi Berra and Nolan Ryan. And Ryan, he went over and read their plaques, and he took a moment with Ernie Banks' plaque. Speaker is a player that he respects, because Biggio and Speaker are the only players to have 50 doubles and 50 stolen bases in a season. He talked a lot about Hank Aaron. And then it was cool when they went over and showed him the actual place where his plaque will go. It's up at the front of the gallery, and it's only about 10 feet away from the plaques of the first class, which was 1936, which Babe Ruth's plaque is right there. So not only is he going in the Hall of Fame, but
all he has to do is walk a few steps to his left, and there's Babe Ruth's plaque. And, I mean, if you're in a club with Babe Ruth, that certainly takes a lot to process.
One of the things he wanted you to do was to write a story on clubhouse attendant Dennis Laborio. Can you just talk about the story and why Craig wanted to know that Dennis was in his thoughts?
Yeah, Dennis was the club Astros clubhouse attendant for, or equipment manager, I should say, for over 30 years. And Dennis really took care of a lot of the players. And as you know, Richard, a lot of the players in Houston, especially through the era of the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s when they went to the World Series, Dennis was their right-hand man. He got them what they needed. And he was forced to retire a few years ago for health problems. And as it turns out, that he's battling Alzheimer's right now. But he and Biggio became very good friends when Biggio came up to the major leagues in 1988. A lot of the players were quite a bit older than him, the Bill Dorns and Buddy Bells and Nolan Ryan. So although Dennis was a little bit older than Craig, they still had a kinship. They both were from New England, and, you know, they had thick accents. And so they went hanging out together, and they would have lunch, and they became really close friends. And I think for Craig to go into the Hall of Fame and not be able to share this with Dennis, although Dennis is still here, he's really struggling right now, and not to be able to have Dennis really with him going into the Hall of Fame, and I think that's the one guy that he really regrets he's not going to be able to share it with. So, yeah, he reached out to me, and there were some things he wanted to say about Dennis and what he meant to his career. And he told a great story that the first day he showed up to Major League Camp, he went looking for Yogi Berra because Yogi Berra came out Eaton Hall when Craig was in college and with John McMullen, and they scouted him. And so when Yogi Berra is scouting you, that's kind of an amazing deal. And Yogi Berra was an Astros coach at the time, so Craig burst into the clubhouse, and he's like, "Hey, where's Yogi Berra?" And Dennis, you know, controlled the clubhouse, and Dennis like, "Who the blank are you?" And he's like, "I'm Craig Biggio." And so, and you know, that kind of started a friendship that lives to this day. And I know it's going to be tough on Craig when he gets up there July 26th and talks about those that have helped his career and that are friends of his. And I'm sure he's going to mention Dennis's name.
Let's touch on the field briefly. With 2 weeks to go till spring training, how do you think Jeff Luhnow feels about the additions, the changes he was able to make to the club? Do you feel like he feels he significantly improved the club, or how would he assess it? And there's always things you don't get to do, but he did a lot.
Yeah, he did a lot. And I think they checked all their boxes they wanted to check, except for adding a starting pitcher at the bottom of the rotation. But that was not as important to them as bolstering the bullpen, which they did very quickly, and adding some thump to the lineup, which they did here in the last couple of weeks. You know, if they could add a starter, great. If not, they'll go to war with what they have and hope one of the young guys like Mark Appel can step up. But they still feel, you know, pretty good about their pitching rotation. And if you look at the rotation last year, it wasn't bad. I mean, what killed them was not holding leads and really not scoring enough runs, although their offense was improved. So they checked all the main boxes. By adding Neshek and Gregerson, the bullpen is in pretty good shape, I think. You add Rasmus and Lowry and Evan Gattis to the lineup, Valbuena at third. So half your lineup is going to be new, but these are guys that within the last year or two have all had very fine seasons, and a couple of them like Gattis could really thrive, even Rasmus in a new ballpark and a new setting. So, yeah, they're going to hit a lot of home runs. I think they're going to strike out a lot, but at the end of the day, they think they're going to produce more runs and score more runs, and they think with the additions they made to the bullpen, they're going to save more games, and that should add up to more wins. I know Luhnow thinks that they have a chance to be a winning team, and, you know, if I had to guess right now, I would have them pegged as an 80-82 win team, a 500 team, and considering where they were just 2 years ago, going from 51 wins to 81, I think in 2 years would be a huge step in the right direction.
Where do you think Evan Gattis will get his at-bats? Will it come all over? And do they feel he can play left field well enough that he won't kill them defensively?
Yeah, I think they will come all over. I mean, a lot of it, I think, is going to depend on John Singleton. And if he has a good spring and he goes into the season as the starting first baseman, then you're going to have to figure out how to get the Carters and the Gattis into the lineup. But if Singleton struggles and is in the minor leagues, it makes it easier. Now you can put Gattis at first or Carter at first, put the other one at DH. But I think at the end of the day, he will play some first. He's going to DH. He will play some left. I think if he gets a lot of time in left field, I think it could be a situation where you get to the seventh inning, you could see him coming out and they replace him with, you know, I'm a Risnick or Robbie Grossman or Alex Presley, somebody else in left field. So they hope that the three or four bats he gets before then, he does some damage. But he also got to remember left field in Minute Maid Park is not very challenging. I mean, Carlos Lee was not a great defender, but he played left field for 5.5 years and put up pretty terrific offensive numbers for much of that time. And so if he's hitting the ball and driving in runs and hitting the ball over the Crawford boxes, I think they can stick him in left field. And even though admittedly he's not a good fielder, I don't think he'll be too much of a liability out there.
So one of the guys he acquired is Colby Rasmus to play center field. Do I read this correctly that Colby was Jeff's very first draft pick when he was scouting director of the Cardinals, or was that his second year?
No, he was the first. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and Chris Perez was his second. Was the second guy, but Chris Perez was the first guy that made the big leagues. I mean, so Colby Rasmus has an interesting reputation. I guess he's through the years has been viewed as uncoachable, maybe rubbed some people the wrong way. But he's now 28 years old. What's Jeff's personal relationship with Colby, and how does he see Colby fitting in and helping the Astros?
Well, they have a very good personal relationship, and I think that went a long way more than anything at that and the $8 million to getting him here and having an opportunity to play. And Colby made it no secret that, you know, he's a Southern boy. He's from the South. He likes it here. He's got family in the area. I think it's his father-in-law who lives in Louisiana, so it's a short drive away. So that's a lot different than playing in Toronto, where everything's totally different than it is in Houston pretty much. So with that and Luno coming in or being reunited with Luno, I think it makes fit for a lot of reasons. You know, I don't think Jeff would bring anybody in who he doesn't think is going to fit or would be uncoachable. You know, you got to remember last year they went through some things where guys didn't mesh. Look at what Jeff and Bo Porter, they just didn't get along, and that ended up poorly. And I think one of the things going into this camp is going to be chemistry. They need some good chemistry, and I think they wouldn't have brought Rasmus in if they didn't think he would contribute on the field and have good chemistry. Hey, if you look at the history of the Astros, even over different managers and different GMs, guys who have been uncoachable or troublemakers, not to say that Rasmus has been those guys, they've come here and played well, from Carl Everett to Jeff Kent. Even when Brent Myers was here for 2.5 years, he pitched very well. So Houston has a history of being a place where guys who have had a little bit of baggage or question marks can come and feel comfortable, and they perform pretty well.
Well, it's going to be it certainly has the feel of a different team and a different spring training. So we'll see how it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds. And we appreciate your time. We'll talk to you again soon, Brian.
All right, Richard.
Joined by my old pal, T.R. Sullivan, who covers the Rangers for MLB.com. T.R., I wanted to ask you, Jeff Banister is maybe your eighth manager, did I count up, or seventh? I mean, you and I have been doing this for a while. Let me ask you this.
I lost count of Bobby Valentine.
Yeah, okay, all right. But let me ask you this. Knowing, having done this for a while, what are the things that you think make a good manager, and how has the job changed over the last couple of years as you look at Jeff Banister taking up this challenge?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at the history of baseball, you know, you go back way back, the managers ruled with an iron hand. I mean, they didn't take any guff from any player, and it was my way or the highway. You know, I'm talking about, you know, you go John McGraw, Casey Stengel, guys like that, you know, they rule with an iron hand. Nowadays, managers have to be more, you know, in tune with their players, their personalities. You know, they have to deal with them. You know, they have to motivate a little bit more. They have to handle the clubhouse. You know, I think that's number one right now to me is, you know, how you gain the respect of your players, you gain the trust of your players. Are they going to play hard for you? I mean, that was the beauty of Ron Washington. I mean, the Rangers played hard every single day for him. They loved him. They respected him. You know, they trusted him. And, you know, that's what Jeff Banister has to do is gain that same trust and that same work ethic. And, you know, once you do that, all the other things that, you know, managers do, you know, work the bullpen, get the lineup straight every day, you know, call the bunt at the right time, all those neat things that baseball fans love to dissect, those will fall into place.
And as we look at the Rangers going forward, they may be the most interesting team in baseball because you can see there's – Tony La Russa used to say the goal to get to spring training is have the fewest ifs. Well, the Rangers have a long list of ifs, you know, if Odor, if Fields. fielder, if Moreland, or, you know, all that. Is there one area of the team, other than Prince Fielder's health, that you think has John Daniels most curious, anxious, whatever word you want to use, as we go to Surprise Arizona?
Yeah, I mean, if you just throw the baseball cards down there and look at who the Rangers are putting out there, you know, for the most part, you got to like the lineup, you know, Prince Fielder, Shin-Soo Chu, Yu Darvish, all those guys. But then you look at the health issues, and, you know, they're no longer baseball cards. They're serious issues. But, you know, if you look at it, you know, left field is still unknown. You know, you got a lot of guys out there. The bullpen's still unknown. They're very short on the left-handed side, especially after they traded Robbie Ross last week. So I think, you know, left field and, you know, the bullpen, and, you know, maybe a right-handed bat off the bench. Those are, you know, the three things that you might look at.
I mean, the Ross for the LSU kid, Renato. Am I saying his name right? Renato?
Anthony Renato, yes.
Is a fascinating trade in that there are two guys that the organizations liked, both guys. How do you look at that trade, and how do you think, what prompted the Rangers to do it? Because at one time, Robbie Ross looked like he was on his way to being a dominant reliever and didn't excel as a starter. What do you think appealed to the Rangers about this trade and made them willing to let Robbie Ross go?
Well, it's an interesting trade in that the Rangers traded from a weakness. You know, they need left-handed relief. John Daniels has made that clear even before trading Robbie Ross. They were out looking for left-handed relief, and they gave one away. Well, they didn't give one away. They traded one away, and they got a good, young, starting pitching candidate, and I think that's what John Daniels was looking at, is that, you know, maybe we hurt ourselves a little bit in the short term as far as a need, but we got a kid that was, you know, 39th overall pick in the draft. You know, one time was a top prospect for the Red Sox. You know, he's had some arm issues. Didn't throw as hard as, you know, he'd like a top prospect to throw. But, you know, when you look at the Rangers' rotation, you got to remember that, you know, three guys are going to be free agents after this season. You know, Colby Lewis, Ross Detweiler, and Giovanni Gallardo. So you want as much depth as you possibly can. I think just the fact that they could get a really quality, you know, young arm who can start, you know, superseded the fact that they, you know, they gave away, again, they traded away a left-handed reliever in an area that they need help in.
Yeah, and Robbie Ross was an interesting guy in that, what happened to him last year? Do you think it was as simple as health, or was he just a guy that's not cut out for the rotation?
Well, you know, Robbie is not an overpowering reliever, and he's not an overpowering pitcher. And, you know, he might be better suited to start if you look at the Rangers. You know, they had plenty of starter candidates until they had all the injuries, so they were kind of forced to put him into rotation, and he wants to start. He's kind of an overachiever and a guy with three-pitch mix more than being, you know, the dominant relief type that you look for. So it's hard to say exactly where he fits in, but I think the Rangers kind of looked at him as more of a middle reliever type, and I think that's why they're willing to give him away.
Yeah, and so and you get a guy, Renato, that might be a kind of a top-of-the-rotation guy, or, you know, above average. So as we go into camp, is Chirinos is going to be the starter? Is the competition for the guy behind him, or how do the four catchers stack up, three?
Well, they got Carlos Corporan from the Astros to be the number two catcher. So right now it's going to be Chirinos and Corporan. That's pretty much set. I mean, Chris Jimenez is a veteran catcher who's played the big leagues, and, you know, he can help if needed. But those are the two guys they're looking at. And, you know, Tomas Tolis, they want, you know, further development at AAA. And one of their top prospects is Jorge Alfaro. He's probably going to be at AA, you know, continuing to learn his craft. He's a great talent. He's still raw. You know, he's got a lot to learn about hitting, you know, the right approach, working with pitchers, all the things that a, you know, good young catcher needs to learn.
One of our favorite Rangers is Colby Lewis. And a year ago at this time, we had this conversation. We didn't even know if he had a career left. He makes 29 starts last year, throws 107 innings after having this hip bone shaved, you know, this rare surgery. What do you think he's still capable of doing? And what's the leadership aspect of Colby?
Well, the leadership aspect is huge. I mean, this is a guy that everybody looks up to in the clubhouse. Very solid guy, very low-key guy, great work ethic. I mean, you know, players love him, and that's invaluable. But, you know, obviously it comes down to performance on the field. You know, last year in the second half, he had like a 3.8 ERA in the second half. You know, really showed that he could be the kind of pitcher that he was in 2010, 2011, which was not a dominant pitcher. I mean, he was just a good middle-of-the-rotation starter. You know, a lot of moxie, you know, wasn't afraid to throw strikes, you know, good fastball, you know, excellent breaking ball. I mean, that's kind of what they're looking for him again. You know, you got the big three. You got Gallardo, you got Derek Holland, you got Yu Darvish. Those are the top three in the rotation. If those guys are healthy, then you know, everything else falls into place, and all Colby has to do is be that fourth starter, give him some innings, you know, pitch the way he did, keep him in the ball games, all that good stuff. You know, if the big three at the top do their job, then Colby will fit in fine at the back end of the rotation.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, 1,000 moving parts for the Rangers and see how it works out. Anyway, I appreciate you joining us, TR. Thanks again, as always.
Okay, guys.
Visit the official online shop of Major League Baseball at MLB.com/shop for the largest selection of authentic caps, T-shirts, jerseys, hoodies, collectibles, and more. Get your gear straight from the source, the MLB.com shop.